Hello and welcome to a special edition of the InfoQ and the InfoQ Culture podcast. In this annual year-end wrap-up podcast, we change up our usual method of podcast a bit. Typically, in our podcasts and also on the news and article pieces that you'll find online at InfoQ.com, we really try not to comment too much on the topics we cover. Instead, we try to report. We let our guests comment. We ask the questions and we cover the material. We leave it really up to you to decide on the importance and how you should use that information. On this special year-end podcast, though, we do a bit of pontification of our own. So today we're going to do a little bit of talking. It's our annual year-end wrap-up, and we're joined by all of the podcasters for the InfoQ and the Culture podcast. So hi, I'm Wes Rice. I'm the VP of Technology for Section. I'm chair for QCon SF, and I co-host the InfoQ podcast.
Good day, folks. This is Shane Hasty. I'm the host for the InfoQ Culture podcast, and you can probably hear a lot of background noise coming through from me. I'm sitting on a street corner, literally on a street corner, in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, and I'm here for the Agile Vietnam conference.
Daniel Bryan here. I'm a product architect at DataWire and also news manager at InfoQ, and next year the chair for QCon London. I am currently sat in a hotel in Boston, not quite as exciting as Shane there, but the decor is pretty nice here and the weather in Boston is cold.
And I'm Charles Humble. I am InfoQ's editor-in-chief and I'm in the UK, which is where I live, so I'm at home.
So Shane definitely wins the best background, as Daniel pointed out, when we kick this off.
Yeah.
So let's start off, Shane. So last year, you and Evan Layburn published a book called No Projects. If you were going to write a book this year, what would be the hot trend that you'd cover?
I'd probably want to call it something like Teal Gets Real. Business agility actually starting to become a real thing. Organizations starting to make genuine transformation. I think if there's a thing that's annoyed me over the last done many years, it's the number of organizational quote-unquote transformations that have been nothing to do with transforming ways of working. They've just been putting a veneer over the old way of doing things. And inevitably, nothing really changes. There's no improvement. There's no better outcomes. But we're starting to see, and I do see it even in some of the big, very traditional organizations, a genuine desire to make real change that does have an impact on customer satisfaction, on employee engagement, and on overall business outcomes.
One shameless plug, Wes, that I actually wrote a book with my buddy Abraham Marin-Perez pretty much a year ago. It's published, Continuous Delivery in Java. And we talked a whole lot of tech in that. And we also talked principles and practices. We were very, you know, conscious to do that kind of thing. But to Shane's point, when we put the book out, there's a lot of, you know, should I use Jenkins? Should I use Java 8? Should I use Java 11? Well, I've actually noticed as I've been going around to various conferences, chatting to folks on InfoQ and so forth, that people are now switching into the higher level questions. I think the message is finally getting into a lot of folks, particularly those of us that have been around for a while, that business outcomes and business value is the important thing. This Kubernetes stuff, awesome as it is, Jenkins, awesome as it is, it's more about delivering value. And people are now saying, what tool can I use to get fast results? Can I minimize downtime? Can I test my complexity? These kind of things, which from my point of view, made me happier. Rather than just recommending tool X or tool Y, I was recommending sort of processes, practices, even goals. What high-level things should you be thinking about, which definitely made me smile, which is nice.
Outcomes over outputs.
Well said, Shane. Yes.
Yeah, there was a tweet that I actually made yesterday. Seems like a great point to bring it up, but it was one from Adrian Cockcroft, and it said, people try to copy Netflix, but they can only copy what they see. They copy the results, not the process. So that transformation that you're talking about, that's that process, and it truly is. It needs to be different for every company. It needs to be adapted and unique. So yeah, it makes total sense.
I suppose a more general observation, but slightly to Daniel's point, I think it's something we've been tracking for a couple of years, but it's most noticeable for me at QCon that the sort of people and process tracks, which used to be in, you know, the smallest room and have such 20 people in them, are now sometimes in the largest rooms that we have in the venues. And again, I think that's to some extent anyway, indicative of this shift, this kind of acknowledgement that it turns out that often in software, the people are the hard bit, and managing people is difficult, and managing projects or work streams or whatever model you want to use for that is difficult. I just think that's a really interesting thing. It maybe is a sign of something of a bit of a growing maturity in the industry. That's something that I'm personally delighted to see. I think as an industry, it's kind of needed to grow up, and maybe it's starting to do that. I think that's intrinsically a good thing.
I'm going to drop in a yes and here. Building from improv, yes, we're seeing this, and there's still a lot of really bad behavior. Some of the best attended sessions at QCon have also been in the ethics track this year, and it was really, really great to see, exploring ethics, exploring software for good. We've known, of course, about the AI ethics challenges, but it goes a lot deeper and bigger than that. People have gone to prison, deservedly so, and talking about things like the codes of conduct for software engineering. What does it actually mean to be an ethical software engineer? Is it a profession? Are we craftspeople? What really is involved in delving into that space?
I think we were somewhat at the beginning of that. I mean, it's sort of slightly risking tooting our own horn here, but we had the ethics track at QCon London 2 years ago, I think.
2 years ago, yep.
And I think we were the first kind of, to my knowledge anyway, I mean, I might be wrong, but I think we were the sort of first cross-discipline conference to do an ethics track. And then Anne Curry, who championed that, spun up a co-ed ethics, which was a UK-based kind of vertical one-day, I think it was one-day event, on ethics on the back of it. And that's then something that we've echoed across the other QCons. And we've also run articles. I published an email on InfoQ on ethics, and also looking at sort of GDPR and regulation and those kind of things. To Shane's point, that is part of this kind of maturity and growing up, but also as an industry, because software is so pervasive, because what we do affects so many people's lives, we really have to think about and take the ethical implications of what we're doing seriously. And I'm really pleased to see that happening more.
I'm really proud of what we're doing with the ethics track, socially conscious software. I think we've pushed quite a few things when it comes to QCon.
We were spoiled for choice last year with all the QCons that run around the world. I've go to the New York, San Francisco, and London ones. So much to choose from. But what's everyone's favorite session or key takeaway from the conference?
Yeah, I'll tell you, my thing I'm the most proud of, I think, this year is the level of keynotes that we had. The keynotes, I think, in 2019 were absolutely incredible. One of the ones that stand out at QCon London, Sarah Wells did a keynote on mature microservices and how to operate them.
Oh, I enjoyed that almost.
It was literally a run book on how the Financial Times, the FT, runs and operates their microservices. It was like, it was just I was writing things down. And as fast as she could say one, I was trying to write down more. And then I was trying to tweet. I just couldn't keep up. There was just so much good stuff that was in there. At QCon San Francisco just a few weeks ago, Pamela Gay did an amazing closing keynote that was just this impassioned plea for the citizen scientist. That was all about how AI falls short and people are needed to be able to actually move this work forward. And I've got chills right now just thinking about it. It was just such an amazing, wonderful keynote. But the one that really, really stands out to me, the one that really was my pick of all of the talks, all of the keynotes for 2019, had to be Nick Caldwell's at QCon New York.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, it really was. And it's right in the same kind of vein of what we're already talking about kind of transformations and leadership and things like that. The talk was Ignite the Fire, how managers can spark new leaders. You can find it on InfoQ if you go out and do it. But it was just, again, packed full of advice on how you can ignite leadership and fire in people. And it literally, you can watch that talk and go out of your office, out of your cubicle, after your desk, and implement things that he talked about. It was just packed full of advice. It was such a great talk.
It was funny too, Wes. Oh, it kept me sort of like chuckling at some points and then thinking, oh, this is actually a really deep point. I need to think about this later, which is for me is a perfect, it triggers some emotion that makes me think. That's perfect, yeah.
No, it was an outstanding talk. It was one, definitely would have been one of my highlights of the year as well. It's, as you say, very, very practical, lots of really good, immediately applicable advice and, you know, properly deep. It was a superb job, I thought.
For me, again, it was some of the ethics and that socially conscious software. Holistic EdTech and Diversity, Anton Paton, talking about his experience as a convicted criminal and coming out from beyond that. So amazing, really deep, powerful conversations that are causing the conversations that need to be had in our industry.
Alex Quinn did that track. She did an amazing job with the track, but she also did an incredible talk that I heard a lot of buzz. I think, Charles, you went to that talk, didn't you?
Her talk was How Do We Heal? We rush published it. We've just published it on InfoQ this week, and it is absolutely outstanding. It was like really raw, really emotional, really personal, but again, also really deep and really making a proper point. I think that would be my talk of the year, actually. It was just completely blew me away. And I kind of wanted to go up to say something to her afterwards, and I was sort of slightly lost for words, really. It was that powerful. Just check it out on InfoQ. I don't want to kind of give too much away about it, but it was really it's just an astonishing talk.
I'll give one thing. Multiple people actually came up to me after the talk. I didn't see it live. I've seen a version of it. But multiple people came up to me afterwards and said that there was a standing ovation after her talk.
Wow.
Again, not trying to give away too much, but it was a really brave talk that came from a really vulnerable and a genuine place. Shane, I think you had a talk that you wanted to highlight that kind of in a similar vein that was a pretty sensitive topic. I think it was in the Optimizing Yourself track.
Yeah, and touching on that one, in fact, Elizabeth Schneider talking about the neurodiversity and starting to tackle those issues as well, which is really great. And yeah, I think as C4 Media, InfoQ, QCon, we can pat ourselves on the back because we are championing these things. We've been putting it out there for longer than I think almost anyone else has.
It's bring your whole self to work, Shane, I think is a key thing as well. And we've been talking about it for quite some time, but I've definitely noticed this year, chatting to other folks at conferences, they are feeling like they can show up. And sure, you want to keep some stuff back. Everyone has a personal life. But being yourself in your workplace where you spend so much time is so, so valuable.
Having the right and the confidence to be able to be yourself, whether you choose to or not, it's up to you. But having that comfort level to be able to do it, I think it's so important at work and at a conference. So speaking of conferences, Daniel, there's a bit of a change for QCon London this year. I've stepped back into a different role and you will be the chair for QCon London. Give us a snapshot. That process is well underway. How's it looking?
Yeah, super excited, Wes. There's so much to do. I've got an increased appreciation of all the plates you were spinning and juggling now. But it's amazing being able to be just a small part because it's a big chain. Got a shout out David from the QCon team, Pierre, or the whole. There's so many folks that if you attend a QCon, you wouldn't see behind the scenes, but they really do keep everything working. And I've only mentioned two names there. It's probably not fair. There's as many more names. But yeah, next year, super excited. We've got a bunch of interesting folks on sort of the program chair contributing ideas and looking for track hosts. Again, I'm only going to shout out a couple of names here just because we've got limited time, but I'm super excited from a track point of view. And the tracks are listed and many talks are now on the website. But we've got a very interesting Kubernetes and cloud architectures track hosted by Crystal Hershorn. And Crystal is doing lots of cool stuff at Condé Nast, very involved. Katie Gamanji, also from Condé Nast, was doing some fantastic work in the KubeCon space that Wes and I were recently at. So very much looking forward to that track. There's also a chaos track. Charles is looking after this one with Nora Jones, Architecting for Success. And I think building resilient systems or sort of curating resilient systems is the next level from distributed systems and microservices. So I'm learning a bunch in that space. So super excited about that one. And finally, like the final one I mentioned, and there's many more tracks, totally recommend folks check out the website. But the final one I want to pull out is Cindy Shaharan is looking after the Leaving the Ivory Tower, Modern Computer Science Research in the Real World. Cindy did a fantastic job. I think it was in New York this year. We had Armon Dadgar from HashiCorp, a bunch of other interesting folks in the track talking about, like in Armon's case, it was how HashiCorp have taken sort of principles from academic research and put it into a commercial company and had fun, made money, but contributed back into academia. So, and Cindy is ridiculously well placed for this kind of stuff. Cindy's blogs are fantastic. Cindy's tweets are fantastic. If you don't follow Cindy Copy Construct on those platforms, you're missing out there. But there's many more things, but those are kind of an insight into my things I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's been a real pleasure to see you and David just doing such an amazing job with this. I'm looking forward to London.
Charles, so looking back at InfoQ over 2019, what are some of the big stories? What are some of the big things that stood out for you?
I think one of the biggest things, we started doing what we call trend reports. We started running those about a little over a year ago, and it was kind of a new content type for us. And they really found their feet this year. So we have these kind of internal discussions amongst the editors when we talk about the trends that we're seeing. We look at publicly available surveys, we look at some private polling we do, and traffic patterns and those kinds of things, trying to get a sense of where our readers are kind of going, the kinds of things that we want to cover. And about a year ago, we started publishing some of these on the site. And it took a little bit of time to kind of get the format right and find the feet. We don't do a lot of opinion content on InfoQ, so even from that point of view, it was kind of a bit novel. But we did one in particular this year on programming languages trends. It was specifically programming language trends excluding Java and JavaScript because we covered those separately. And it kind of exploded. We got a lot of really positive coverage as well. It wasn't one of those ones where it kind of explodes on social because everyone's going, you're wrong and you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, obviously, there's a bit of that. But, you know, on the whole, it was quite well received. So that was probably the kind of standout one. And we were looking at some of the things we're seeing on sort of infrastructure aware and CAD-specific languages. So things like sort of Ballerina and Pulumi and Darklang and some of those. We talked a bit about Rust, which is moving from, we think, from sort of the innovator stage to early adopter. We talked a bit about Python, which has kind of exploded, I think, partly on the back of its kind of roles in data science and also teaching to some extent. We talked about Swift. And also we talked a bit about .NET and .NET Core, which, again, has become amazingly popular from a kind of reader interest point of view, at least on InfoQ, which is, I think, really interesting as well. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, .NET was not something that was, I don't know, hugely kind of trend-setting. But .NET Core, I think, really is in many respects. So, yeah, I think that was probably one of our standout posts.
I want to jump back to your comment about Python for just a second. I recently just read an article that the Tyobi Index had Python jumping Java. We've been hearing for years about the demise of Java. And I say this as a Java developer. Are we finally seeing the demise of Java?
I've worked in computing as a programmer and more recently doing this job for more than 20 years. And I'm pretty sure in almost the entire of that time, Java has apparently been dying. This must be the longest death ever, right? No is the answer. Java really isn't going anywhere. I don't think it's probably getting any bigger than it is. But, you know, depending on which thing you use to benchmark it, is probably the most or the second most widely used programming language. Yes, Python has grown hugely in popularity. As I said, it's also worth saying, you know, a language like JavaScript is probably more widely used than Java. It's just not like the dominant language that most people write big systems in can do, but you probably don't. We, our own sort of reader polling and reader surveying, I think Java is the most widely used language amongst certainly InfoQ's readership. And it's worth saying, I mean, the TIOB index is somewhat discredited. I mean, I do think it's worth keeping an eye on. I do think it's a signal, but it's only a signal. That said, the rise of Python is really interesting. I mean, Python and Java are basically the same age, I think, more or less. I'd have to look that one up to be absolutely certain, but they're roughly the same age. They came at about the same time. And Python's sort of sudden rise to popularity, I think, is genuinely interesting. And as I say, a lot of that, I think, has been driven off data science and whatever. But yeah, if you're a Java developer, you don't need to go and look for a new language just yet. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I was going to say Python's rise, personally, I think, is more a rise of the data science, machine learning kind of explosion that we're seeing over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Daniel, this is also your space. What do you think?
Yeah, like the phrase I say, you know, Java is dead, long live Java, is the thing we've been hearing for so many years these days, yeah. But what I would say is it's everywhere. Java is pervasive, so there's clearly going to be maintenance work. I personally think the language, particularly when we got lambdas and so forth in Java 8, is fantastic. So there's always incremental work going on. We had a fantastic post by Brian Goetz on InfoQ. He explained more about the new types coming into Java or new var types. And there's always innovative work going on, but I think Java language is actually really, really good. A lot of hipsters in the Java JVM space I chat to are looking at Kotlin. They're not necessarily using it commercially, not necessarily even using it in their day jobs, but they like Kotlin. Kotlin's very easy to write, easy to read. It's quite expressive in some ways that perhaps Java isn't, or Java's more verbose. But I still think Kotlin, other than, say, outside of Android, for true commercial adoption is probably, you know, a year or so off. But I'm with Charles, as in, I do Java as kind of my native language. And as much as I don't code that much now, I'm not worried. I think, you know, I've know a bit of Go and know a bit of JavaScript. I reach hopefully for the right tool for the job, but I think Java's, you know, is still good for a few more years.
There's also quite a bit of innovation going on in the VM side. So I know GraalVM has been popular at QCons. I know we've covered it on InfoQ, but some of the things like the ahead of time compilation that GraalVM does, I think that's really interesting for people that are using dynamic scripts, for example.
That podcast you did, Wes, was fantastic with the GraalVM folks.
Yeah, I can't comment a lot in there. Last time I wrote code in Angular, it was in C++. Still a good language.
Still a good language, Shane. Still a good language.
Still jobs for C++ programmers too.
Yeah. I discovered to my horror a little while ago, I can still read a hex dump in an assembly code.
Nice. It's like riding a bike, Shane.
That code's not too far off. Some of the trends, and I'm sure we're going to cover it here in a bit with WebAssembly, being able to put compiled binaries into browsers and into different locations. C++, that you could totally put that into a browser now and run a whole application like Photoshop or what is it, AutoCAD in a browser, right?
It brings that question back, Wes. Just because you can, should you?
Touche, sir. Touche.
All right. So Shane, let's switch gears off languages for just a bit. You're doing a keynote in the morning, I believe, and you're talking about business agility. What in the world is business agility?
Oh, is it just another buzzword? Keynote is titled The Edge of Agility, and I'm looking at what's actually happening in that space. I start with an assertion, Agile is dead, and I pull out a number of the InfoQ articles and news items that address that statement. But then we look at the state of Agile surveys and see that actually, yeah, it might be dead, but it's now 96% of organizations say that they're using Agile in one form or another for their software development. In our InfoQ trend report, we've pushed vanilla Agile to the far right-hand side. It is the space of the late majority today. But what we're seeing coming up in the early adopter and in the innovator space is what I called earlier, teal getting real, organizations getting real about making the genuine shift, building on a platform of strong technical agility to enable the real customer-focused, outcome-focused benefits. And the State of Business Agility report spoke about benefits that organizations are getting: increased revenue, faster turnaround time, better relationships, greater transparency, customer satisfaction, employee satisfaction being two of the biggest measurable benefits of adopting these new ways of thinking and working. Sustainable organizations, market success, profitability. But there's also a whole lot still of misconceptions and self-deception in the State of Business Agility report. They measure, and these are self-reported, they've got five categories of how well are you doing, from sitting, crawling, walking, running, flying. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, actually. Fully flying is a 10 out of 10. In the self-reported executive level, C-level executives reckon that they're on average a 5.4. So we're walking quite well. We're moving towards running a little bit over halfway along the journey. Whereas the line of business leaders are saying we're a 4.1. We're crawling. Middle managers, 5.1. Individual contributors, the people on the ground doing the work, 3.9. We are crawling and it hurts. And then the external partner was really interesting. So what does it look like to your organizations outside? And they're saying a 4.3. So there's a lot of self-deception going on at the leadership and managerial levels in organizations. And I think that's hurting.
So that sounds like a really important trend. What are some of the other trends that we're all seeing for the upcoming year that we feel like we should focus on?
Yeah, it's kind of riffing on Shane's idea there, but from a very perhaps different perspective. Like, I do a lot of stuff with AWS and Kubernetes and Service Mesh and API Gateway, and we're definitely seeing a realization of the complexity. And the complexity often correlates with bad business outcomes, I think, because developers are simply overwhelmed with, you know, how do they create good architectures? SREs and platform folks are overwhelmed with what we call toil. They're literally just doing sort of things to fight fires, because like Kubernetes is an amazing tool, amazing sort of foundation of a platform, but it is genuinely quite complicated. So I'm definitely seeing a move towards building tools that support reducing some of that complexity. So there's something in Kubernetes called CRDs, custom resource definitions. People are picking this up as a kind of standard way now to define their infrastructure. Given that Kubernetes is a kind of standard platform, if you like, and both Google and Azure, and of course all the other clouds are offering Kubernetes as a service, they're now almost homogenizing on that as the compute foundation. So we're building tools now to make it easy to configure not only the services going into these platforms, I'm deploying my service, my application, but making it easy to deploy, say, routing to these services, both from a north-south point ingress, but also from a east-west like service-to-service mechanism, and using the same workflow. At the moment, the way you deploy stuff in Kubernetes, the way you release stuff is very separate. And I like the idea of separating deploy and release, but I'd like to use the same workflow. So I'm hoping, let's say, that trend continues over the next year or so, where we just reduce the complexity and make the workflows more standardized. Because all I want to do as a developer is write code, push it out easily, and control the release to the users and get the feedback to see if I'm making a difference.
You want to focus on that business logic and leave the differentiated heavy lifting to the tools that you need for your application. Charles, what about you?
The stuff that I've been tracking with the most interest is quantum computing still. And we talked about this last year, actually, but I'll talk about it again because it's just super, super interesting. So there are a couple of big announcements this year. IBM published a paper in Nature in, I think it was May, when they were talking about having found a way of dealing with decoherence, which is the issue with decoherence is that the fast decay of a wave function has kind of undesirable side effects in terms of generating noise and so forth. So having a solution for that is really interesting. And then in September, Google announced also via a paper in Nature that it had built a machine that they claimed had achieved quantum supremacy, which is the rather kind of overblown term that means that we have a machine that can outperform what a classical computer can do. Now, it's worth saying that that paper has been disputed by IBM and by several others as well. But I think it does kind of point to the fact that this technology is really moving very, very quickly. And then just this week, AWS announced something called Amazon Braket, which is a fully managed service for working with quantum computers from different manufacturers. So D-Wave, IonQ, and Rigetti are in there. So they're not the first to do that. Microsoft has Azure Quantum. IBM has their Q machines available on their cloud and have done for a couple of years, actually. But it still kind of blows my mind that we can all be sitting at home, you know, kind of in our offices, bedrooms, whatever, and be running actual code on actual quantum computers. And I think it speaks volumes to this shift to the cloud and what that means in terms of, you know, these machines are kind of esoteric. They're expensive to buy. They're difficult to run and manage. They need very specific environments, but that's fine because you can have IBM or Amazon or Google or whoever do that for you, which I think is really, really exciting. So I think that kind of combination of ubiquitous cloud computing, ubiquitous connectivity, and these new quantum machines is something that I think is really exciting and worth keeping an eye on. I guess, Wes, I know you've had a lot of interest in kind of edge compute, which is slightly the other trend. So do you want to talk a little bit about that maybe?
Yeah, totally. So the trends that I'm tracking that I think are really taking over software, obviously with Kubernetes that Daniel's talking about, couldn't agree more. That is the new app server. It is the fabric that we deploy on now. Totally with edge computing. And when we talk about edge computing, usually the first question is, what edge are we talking about? A lot of times as server-side application developers, when we talk about edge, we're talking about the edge of the cloud infrastructure, the edge coming into the cloud provider. And I'm talking about edge. I'm talking about, if you think of that telco concept of the last mile, between that last mile to that cloud edge, there's an amazing richness of available compute resources out there. How many cell towers are in the United States? What if we could run a Kubernetes cluster there? What if we could actually take these machine learning models with this Python that we were just talking about code and be able to aggregate, build models, make local decisions at a cell tower for different products that we're building? So edge compute, I think that there is just this huge, and I didn't even cover the device edge, right? That's the actual devices, the millions and billions of devices that all need IP addresses, but they're all going to be out there that are consuming data and bringing that back. So yeah, edge compute, I think, is a huge amount. The machine learning that we talked about last year, I think that continues to become more and more approachable for somebody without a PhD to be able to build these models. So yeah, edge compute, machine learning, and Kubernetes, I think, are the three things for me. Shane, anything you want to add?
Yeah, two things. One of them for me is your company is not Spotify.
Yes. Well said, Shane. Well said.
There's a whole lot of pushing out there to tribes, squads, guilds. They've become the latest cargo cult. Please, please, please be inspired by, but do not copy. And even back in 2012, when Hendrik spoke about the Spotify model, at that point, he told us it was temporary. It was what they were using then. It was changing then, but unfortunately we see, and I'm going to point the blame squarely at some of the really big consulting firms that have latched on to, oh, here is a transformation, quote-unquote, model, and more it's lipstick on a pig again. And at a personal, passionate level, there's a piece that I'd like to draw people's attention to, which we reported on in InfoQ, that's what does it mean to be an agile nation? Now, I'm a New Zealander. This was in response to the terrorist attack in February this year and the way that our country responded. And Dr. Rashina Hoda is a Muslim lady living in Auckland, and she gave a really inspiring and deeply moving TED talk, a TEDx talk at TEDx Auckland in August, where she looked at the way New Zealand society responded and linked it to what she called the four values for an agile society. And I want to just read them out. People and interactions over protocols and rules. Community collaboration over closed decision-making. policies and actions over speeches and promises, and responding to change over following the status quo. And if we think about that as a societal level, it's inspiring.
Agreed.
Wow, Shane. We still have one more question to ask. How are we supposed to follow that?
That's deep. Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so we are near the end of the podcast. This is the last podcast of the year, I believe. So it would only be fitting, only be appropriate for us to commit on some New Year's resolutions. Just to kind of, I think, Charles, we're up at like 2 million downloads. So if you put this resolution out there, fully expect that you're going to be held accountable. So, Daniel, New Year's resolutions for 2020.
Awesome. So my personal one, which I say every year, is not to travel as much, but I love traveling, yeah, and I love meeting everyone on the road from InfoQ for DataWire. It's in QCon, of course. It's awesome. So that's my personal note. From a more software kind of note, I think it is encouraging folks and reminding myself to focus on the business outcomes. As much as I love the tech, don't get me wrong, and I think the tech is super valuable, it is really a tool to delivering value to society, be that monetary value, be that good outcomes, as Shane's already mentioned. So I'm really trying hard as a New Year's resolution to remember that. Charles, what are you thinking about?
That's a great one. I was going to mention traveling less as well. I suspect that's going to be a bit of a theme. I think all of us do maybe travel more than we should. I think the other big thing for me this year is actually going to be focusing back on the core of what InfoQ does and trying to just iterate on that and improve that and scale that more. For a variety of reasons, I've had my attention pulled in other areas for the last year or two, and it's been a lot of fun, but I'm really looking forward this coming year to kind of getting back to the core of my job, which is the online business, and, you know, trying to really double down on what we do there. I feel tremendously lucky, actually. I feel that it's a tremendous privilege to work on InfoQ every day, and I really, really want to give it more of my attention, so I'm kind of thrilled about that. Shane, how about you?
What can we do to make more joyous workplaces? Richard Sheridan published the book this year, and we've done an author Q&A with it, Chief Joy Officer. The trends in our organizations are about customer value comes from happy employees. How can we have more joyous workplaces?
I'm sensing a trend here about working at a higher level, less on the tools, focusing on the people, focusing on the processes and the journey towards delivering software. I'm going to talk about technology.
Cool. You're allowed.
Yeah, this is a Java developer. I want to dive more into Python. I think I said the same thing last year and didn't do it. So I failed on that front a bit. Definitely want to get some machine learning projects off the ground in the edge space. I'd love to get involved a bit more, do some more with some of the things that are happening with WASM and WASI. I'm just really impressed with some of the stuff that I've seen. Ashley Kaiser's talked quite a bit about WebAssembly if you go back to some of the last year's QCons. So yeah, that's my interest. I totally hear you. It's all about business outcomes. These are enablers for getting the job done. You're 100% right. But yeah, I'm going to want to play with some technology this year.
That's nice. That's good.
All right, gentlemen, this was fun. I enjoyed it.
Me too.
I look forward to catching up. Just from my perspective, I want to say that I'm like just incredibly humbled and privileged to work with each and every one of you. You're all amazing technologists. I learn something from you every time we have a conversation. Shane, you inspire me. Charles, you keep me on track. Daniel, you just keep pushing deeper for me, and I love it. So from me to you all, thank you so much, and I hope you have an amazing, amazing new year.
Thank you so much, Wes.
I like the sentiment. Happy New Year to Wes and everyone else.
As always, everybody, thank you for joining us on the InfoQ and the InfoQ Culture Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you in an amazing 2020. Thank you all.